Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are on paper 41, section 5, which is old single column, page 460. All right. Before we start with section 5, I decided I'd go back and do a little bit more with the fourth paragraph in the previous section. So, you know, section 4, paragraph 4 there, the one that starts with one of your nearby sons. One of the things that came out as we were doing that one last time, is that modification that's been made to that that paragraph over the years, and in recent years, you know, it bounces back and forth. I thought it was worth touching, going through that in a little bit more detail, not only to help to clear up that issue. It's a good example of to help everyone to avoid certain inescapable pitfalls that are in engaging, that are inherent in engaging a revelation, and also. Give you a little example of, you know, we talked about it for quite a while last time, but you can always, you know, engage any paragraph deeper and deeper and deeper. I'm always, you know, as we're going through it, it may seem like, you know, we spend 2 hours on just one section. You know, I mean, you could spend 5 hours on one paragraph if you wanted to. Everything has endless ramifications, and I'm always making decisions like, well, okay, I'm not going to talk about that. Okay, let me talk about this. I mean, there's no way that you can follow every consequence or every linkage that's attached to a given paragraph, because they're endless. The book is designed to last the fullness of humanity at an intellectual level that we don't even currently possess for 1,000 years. Okay, so there's nothing trivial about any sentence in the book. Every sentence goes beyond anything you can imagine, you know, that it's talking about, by definition. let's just look at that paragraph a little bit more. I'm gonna allow a little bit more science discussion, you know, into the conversation. Because obviously, when you're dealing with material like in papers 41 and 42, if you're going to take it even further, that's what you're doing. You're going beyond sort of the immediate philosophic recognition, you know, and engaging it, transitioning into a more directly scientific examination of the consequences of the paragraph. So let's take a look at that. I'll just read it, you know, in here and unpack it as I go. Okay, so they start out with the statement that one of your nearby sons. Okay, and when they tell you that something is nearby like that, in the case of these stars, you should be thinking already. Okay, probably. This is an object that's close enough that I could, even in spite of current human limitations, you know, with reasonable 20th century, 21st century technology, I could probably start to get some decent data about this. So I can, the revelation could point to that object. And I could use it as an anchor point to help to ground a more objective scientific picture of what's going on. Like we've been talking about, that's what they're doing so much, is trying to give us hints and anchor points to help us to be able to develop a true science. You know, so the fact that they tell you it's nearby, that you should be curious about that. It's like, okay, this is probably talking about something that I can observe with a fair amount of detail. It's not going to be something that's way off and I can only get very vague, fuzzy information about. Okay, and then they say, so one of your nearby suns, which started life with about the same mass as yours, has now contracted almost to the size of Urantia, having become 60,000 times as dense as your sun. And like we were saying, you know, if your book says 40, it should say 60. Like I said, that's what's motivating me to look at this paragraph a little bit more. Why is it that someone at some point, or people on an ongoing basis have thought that they should change the word 60 to 40? Okay. Well, I mean, I know, but we don't need a, let's just start with the 60. Pretend it just says 60 and hasn't been changed. And just think about it, as objectively as possible, just what you have immediately presented. Okay, so they're talking about a star that started with about the same mass as our sun. Okay, I mean, think about that. It doesn't say that is about, it says it started about the same mass. So what's the implication? Well, it must not be as massive as that anymore. It must have lost mass, or they wouldn't have said it that way. But it did start with about the same mass as our sun. And then they say it has now contracted almost to the size of Urantia. Okay. Without, getting an exact ratio of the radius of the sun, of our sun, to the radius of the Earth, like we mentioned, it's a good thing, rule of thumb data point to have in the back of your mind, the comparison of the sizes of the Earth, Jupiter, and the sun as a reminder for relating to the architectural worlds. That Jupiter's about 10 times the diameter of the Earth and the sun is about 100 times the diameter. Okay. So just that, that rough ratio. So think about that. What's the consequence of what they say when they say it's now contracted almost to the size of Urantia? It's like, well, okay, I'm going to assume that if it started about the same mass as our sun, it probably, when it was the same age as our sun, was probably about the same diameter as our sun. Obviously it's an assumption, but they're most likely giving me something that's typical, and they tell us our sun is typical, so that's not an unreasonable assumption. Okay, so if it started out about the same size and has contracted to now the size of our planet, a factor of 100 decrease, well then the density would have gone up by a factor of 1,000,000. 100 cubed would have gone up by a factor of 1,000,000. Oh, well, now I see why they didn't stop the sentence, Urantia, period. They have a verb phrase following. They say, having become 60,000 times as dense as your sun. Ah, okay, well, that definitely tells me it's lost mass. It's lost quite a bit of mass. I mean, its density is not 1,000,000. It's only 60,000 times as dense as the sun. Okay, so just out of curiosity, what would that imply? So now think about this. I mean, think about what they can tell you because you can't figure it out, and then what they won't tell you because you can figure it out. Okay. There's no way for me to know, for us to fail to figure out what the average density of this star that's, many light years away is. So they can tell me that. I mean, I can maybe assume various things. I assume I know what's going on inside of it and try to deduce it or something like that. But, you know, that's nothing that I'm going to be able to easily just know. So they could just tell me that. They can tell me it's 60,000 times as dense. You know, for instance, if I thought maybe it was initially about the size of our sun, and now I somehow figured out it was now about the size of the Earth, I'd probably assume it was a million times, you know, and be working with a, you know, an incorrect data point to tell me it's 60. Okay, so think about that. If they actually tell you that its density is only 60,000 times instead of a million times, you can calculate what its mass is now. Yeah. If it's you know, if it was a million, its mass would be, you know, one solar mass. If it's 60,000, then what's its mass? Well, if you do a little quick calculation, you'll see it means that the mass of that star is somewhere between 4 and 5 hundredths of a solar mass. Yeah, it's quite a bit less than one solar mass now, where it started. 4 to 5 hundredths of a solar mass. Okay, before you go any further, you should remember, you know, see, at that point, you go, oh, wait, they made a point of mentioning, you know, back in the 1, 2, 3, the fourth paragraph of section 3, that if a star is in a normal gaseous mode, you know, if it's basically just a, you know, fully functioning star and it's, you know, essentially gaseous all the way through, that those objects are in a range from 1/10 of a solar mass to about 30 solar masses. Oh, so this one is well below the 1/10. Well, what did they say back there? They said, when less than 1/10 the size of your sun, and they're talking about mass, as they explain later, so less than 1/10 the mass of your sun, these fiery spheres rapidly contract, condense, and cool. Ah, okay. You know, it's well below a tenth, so it's well into that mode where it's a very old object that is in that mode of contracting, condensing, and cooling. And it's, so in other words, it's not really a fully active functioning star. It's, you know, it's waning. Remember what they say at the very end of this paragraph that we're studying, you know, a faint reddish glow, the senile glimmer, you know, the very old glimmer of a dying monarch of light. Yeah, okay, that all matches up and makes sense. Okay, so sounds like they're going to tell me some more about these very old objects. Similar to what they did back there in section 3. Remember, they talked about how when things are getting really old, they can start to get solid, you know, to a large degree instead of gaseous. Okay. Yeah, right. I mean, they're calcifying, they're fossilizing, they're right. The senile, you know, very old glimmer, right? You notice the parallel. Okay, so, you know, it's like, okay, so this is interesting. They've given me some idea of what its mass is. What else do they say? Okay, then they say, the weight of this hot, cold, gaseous solid is about 1 ton per cubic inch. Okay, before we... you know, get into what, you know, I'm supposed to be thinking in the, you know, reading that. Let's consider the detour that people have taken right here. Okay. People can easily do a little back of the envelope calculation. You know, when it says it's 60,000 times as dense as your sun, and they can look up the density of the sun, and it's, You know, like we were talking about last time, it's about 1.4, or even if you made it maybe a little closer to 1.5, like the Revelators seem to be hinting at a little bit. You know, you can convert grams per cubic centimeter, the density, to tons per cubic inch. And so you do this. You like facts. You're born in the modern age. You were trained since grade school to think about facts, engage facts, do some basic arithmetic with facts, you know, and so you do it out of curiosity. Okay? And the 60,000 times 1.4 grams per cubic inch turns out to be about 1.5 or a little more grams per cubic centimeter. Excuse me, I said, yeah, that 60,000 times 1.4 grams per cubic centimeter turns out to be about 1.5 or a little bit more tons per cubic inch. Okay, and you're very, very precise about your facts. You know how to work your calculator, and you do it precisely. And you're going, wait a minute, I don't think 1.5 is 1, is about 1. There must be a typo here. Looks to me like it should be reduced by a third. You know, take 1.5 down to 1, take 60 down to 40. Okay. And so the two facts seem to match.
Okay. Sounds like what the Pharisees used to do in the old days when they're writing the Bible.
Right. I mean, the Pharisees were an example of individuals who were very detail oriented. Very, you know, they want to be very precise, dot all the I's, cross all the T's, thinking very factually. Okay. Okay, so, I mean, that's why it's changed. Now, step back and put on your philosophic hat instead of your scientific hat or your analytic hat, you know, and being able to convert grams per cubic centimeter to tons per cubic inch. Think about, philosophically, about what you're assuming when you conclude that it needs to be changed from 60 to 40. You're concluding, you're assuming that the Revelators have no problem in wasting all of that space in the book to convert grams per cubic centimeter to tons per cubic inch. That's the best thing they could think of doing with a certain amount of real estate in the Revelation. You need to ask yourself, does that feel true? Obviously, you could convince yourself that that's okay. I mean, you could come up with a number of rationalizations why you could justify why you think they did that. I mean, maybe, you know, you would even rationalize that they're trying to make it for those who aren't very sophisticated, you know, and might not be able to convert grams per cubic centimeter to tons per cubic inch. You know, and that's why they did it, so that to make it more, you know, approachable for the common man.
And the people who did make it changed, rationalize it even in a different way.
Yeah, I know how they did, but not going off on why they did. I mean, it's really, I mean, what I'm trying to get you at is figuring out how you should rationalize it, or how others, figuring out the details of how someone else. No, you're doing if you do that, you're doing putting facts first. Don't start with facts. Like I said, one of the reasons we're going through this is you need to develop an appreciation for how to approach the book. Okay? Not closing your eyes to facts, but understanding that the basic purpose is not to reveal facts, it's to reveal truth. Okay? Now, that doesn't mean that's antithetical to fact. But you know, think about, like I said, what are you assuming if all it is just that conversion, if they put the conversion in the book for you? Okay? That would mean they wanted to, reveal, I guess we're going to still say, a fact. Is it really a revelation or even a disclosure of fact to give me a calculation that I can do myself? I mean, it's redundant. It's saying the exact same thing. I know that they have an infinite number of things that they could have told us. They only had 2,000 pages to pick a subset of infinity. Okay? So you should have a bias. Like, it's not too likely that they spent all those words just for that purpose. Another thing that might start to bias you away from that conclusion that you ought to change something is you're going, when you read ton per cubic inch, you're reminded of something. Oh, yeah. After they talked about the 1/10 to 30 range, they talked about how stars are getting really old down in the center. They can be totally solid. And they can get up to a very high density. And it was 1 cubic inch weighed 6,000 pounds. Now it was 3 tons per cubic inch. It's the same way of talking about the density. Rather than grams per cubic centimeter, it's in that tons per cubic inch mode again. Okay. Now let me think about this. What would they, rather than just give me something I can calculate myself, I'm sure they're trying to give me something additional. They're not just repeating themselves. I can convert it. I'm being a little bit more precise I'm noticing that when they said 60, they didn't say about. But when they said ton per cubic inch, they said about. Okay. So in other words, this is another issue. Yeah, I mean, factually, if you convert it, 1.5, it's about. Okay. It's in that ballpark. But what's the truth that's flowing through that? Why is there truth to saying it's about, even if it doesn't sound like it's, it doesn't round to 1. 1.5 or 1.6 rounds to 2, doesn't it? Right? Okay. We figured out because we calculated the mass is now that it's like 4 to 5 hundredths, which is much less than 1/10. And if it's gone very far, it's like 3 tons per cubic inch. Oh, what they're trying to tell me is if it drops below 1/10, there's a range from about 1 ton per cubic inch all the way up to 3 tons per cubic inch as this star continues to, what did they say, contract, condense, and cool. And initially, when it's still not close to the one end, the 1 ton per cubic inch end of that spectrum, like this is, it's not going to be fully solid yet. It's going to be exactly what they said. It's going to be gaseous hyphen solid. All right, it starts out gaseous, right? And then some of it starts to condense to a solid. And you have the beginnings of a gaseous solid. And the density, when it condenses, all of a sudden there's this big, the density goes way up. And the average density in that region. And it starts out that condensing phenomenon. Remember, they focus you on the core in the other one. So let's just kind of do it here. Forget about the outer layers. That central part that's starting to cool, condense. So it starts out at about the 1 ton, and it's a gaseous hyphen solid. It's not a pure solid. And the more it cools, the more it gets towards 3, the more it's pure solid, like they were talking about back there. So they're giving you some physics of these modes of substance that we don't know much about. And they're telling you have this range, gaseous solid to solid, 1 ton to 3 tons per cubic inch. That's something that you could, hang your science on, a rock solid point. That's what they're getting at.
Or the
Okay? All right, so, and think about it. Doesn't that seem more reasonable that they aren't just wasting space telling me something I could calculate, but they're trying to tell me something additional? Okay? Now, I don't want to, we could go on. There's other things too. I'll just give you a hint. The other thing that'll argue against you changing that is when you recognize, if you've ever read anything in a modern science mode, as you're reading things here in the Revelation, you'll notice that it has an antiquity feel to it at times. And remember, they're using human source works. And they were told to not create sequences of words unless they couldn't find someone else that had put together a sequence of words like that, that they could just tweak a little bit. There's a sequence of words in a human source work that has 60, 60,000, and about 1 ton per cubic inch. And they're playing off of that. It's not talking about specifically this. I'm not going to see what they're talking about. You see how they're turning that whole sentence in the human source work 180 degrees around. They're turning it on its head. That's just another level when you, it's not 40. It's supposed to be 60. You know, they're leveraging off a human sequence of words, and they're giving you things that go way beyond, just some simple thing of, I wonder how, what that is in tons per cubic inch. How about pounds per cubic furlong? Who cares about changing the units? What's the new thing that they're telling? And especially, how can you see how they're trying to point out that they're using this example because it's really close to us, and they're saying, this whole bit as you try to start to figure out what's going on in stellar interiors, this will be a really handy one for you because it's really close, and this will help you a lot, with having something to test your theories relative to. Afterwards, if someone wants, to have a little bit more, I could give you some more on that. But just leave it at that right now, just to help you appreciate. You just can't think simplistically. You need to challenge yourself to think very dynamically and beyond what you immediately suspect is going on, so that you can be revealed to. You don't want the book to just affirm that you know how to convert grams per cubic centimeter to pounds per cubic inch. You don't want just an affirmation, and that's what you do to it when you change it to 40. It just becomes an affirmation of your ability to use a calculator and to look up conversion factors. That's not a revelation, that's an affirmation. Okay? It's got to be telling you something that goes beyond anything that humans currently appreciate. That's what you're looking for. Yeah.
So can you tell me who's the human source on that?
That's the Architecture of the Universe by Swan.
Oh.
Yeah. But again, it's not, when you say on that, it's like, well, it's on the sequence of words, some of the sequences of words, but not on the content. What Swan is talking about is totally different. The very fact that they say, well, actually, you've got another star that, we could use that same words for, basically, tweak it a little bit. And
when was it changed?
I think the second printing had 40 in it, didn't it? Didn't someone say they had a second printing? And
I did last week.
Yeah.
I vaguely remember.
But I mean, it's, and it's now standardized. I mean, it's...
No, yeah. I've got one.
But the standardized reference text is 40. They're now standard. Right. So just need to appreciate. It's just an issue of. Remember how it says at the beginning, they give you a warning right in the beginning of the foreword. As you start to engage this, beware. The best you can hope for is less distortion of meaning, and it'll be very easy to do more distortion of meaning. Very easy. You need to be on your guard. Don't Don't go with what you expect to happen. Okay? Don't interpret the paragraph the way you would expect a human to have written it. A human would, you know, would give you just a conversion factor, just to show you how smart they were. Now that they can convert between those two densities, you know, units. Okay? That's not what the revelators are doing. And you know, what are they doing that's unexpected? You know, that's an actual revelation.
So you're a scientist, what are they doing? I mean, in terms of, are they telling you, you know, from a layperson's point of view that, hey, it doesn't quite work out the way you think it does when these guys contract?
Right. Remember, what they're telling you is what I said before when we were going through these last two sections. The whole point is, notice that when we actually give you some genuine data points and you compare that to what you think, everything is opposite. Basically everything. Every star that you think is, in general, that's old is young, and that's young is old, and on like that. I mean, and you know, when we get a little further on, we'll discover why it is that we're so flipped around.
To me, when I read this, without going into that way, I look at it as a whole different thing, you know, just as them trying to give us an example of the way that, you know, they get older or they become denser, so to speak, which is sort of following along what they have been telling us. Because I don't have the scientific knowledge to be able to sit there and go through it in my head. I don't even think the way you do about it.
Right.
That would get something other truth out of it.
You can get an exposure to coordinated essential knowledge. But remember, you know, the book is designed to go beyond just exposing people to an environment, you know, where the knowledge is well grounded.
Yeah, I'm slow.
No. I mean, it's no. But it's no. I mean, all, I mean. Remember, it's, you know, you have no desire to become an astrophysicist, okay? And they're not saying that you have to, but just remember, the book is designed to capture the abilities and the imagination of the most profound astrophysicist that can live for the next 1,000 years, okay? And none of us in this room are that person. This book is able to guide the thinking of someone who is 100 times smarter than me and will live 500 years from now and will be analyzing things I can't even imagine. Okay? I need to remember that. But I can begin to get glimmers of what they could do because I can begin to penetrate into that. If I consecrate myself to that, and so that's what I was telling you. I mean, I can just show you where the doorway is. Put some pieces together, okay?
And you're avoiding one glaring elephant in the room.
Yep.
And that is the mass loss. And so you suspect that they are talking about a sphere that has gone nova or has lost mass in another way.
No, remember the other thing that currents, see, let me just focus on that for a second. So when you say what about this mass loss? What about this very significant loss of mass? Current science would say, well, in order to do that, there must have been some sort of a very cataclysmic event to slough off all of that material. You know, we would see like a big ring nebula around the thing or something. I mean, or some sort of, that's what you'd be looking for. Well, you're not going to find that. Well, it's like, well, then the book is obviously false. No, remember what the assumption is. Current science thinks that the universe is only less than 14 billion years old, 13 point whatever, 7 or something, whatever the latest number is. Okay, just, you know, a star is constantly, you know, there's mass bleeding off of our sun constantly. Tons and tons of mass is flowing out of the sun all the time, okay, out into space. Let it just do that very benign, natural thing for trillions and trillions of years. What happens to that star? It evaporates down to something like that. It doesn't have to do it cataclysmically. It has more than enough time for the solar wind to just bleed that amount off. Remember, we pointed out, this is the thing that's also going on with that. They're talking about a star that current science believes can't exist because the universe isn't old enough. Exactly. They're talking about something that's cooled down to near cinder state, and they know that would take trillions of years. The universe is not that old. It's like, no, the universe is plenty old. Not only is the universe plenty old for that star to have been in a normal state for trillions and trillions of years, but the universe is plenty old for it to have cooled for trillions and trillions of years too. Okay? And see, remember, the current understanding of the energy generation puts it on the order of billions, everything. That's why everything is billions. It's because of our limited knowledge. There's a whole 3 orders of magnitude more depth to the phenomenon. That's why everything is trillions and not billions. And that's how ignorant of energy generation we are. Okay. So the whole paragraph, is just completely revolutionary. Not to mention masterly use of human sequences of words. And the more you study it, the more you will just, stand in awe of the authors. That's the point, okay? There's nothing awesome about converting grams per cubic centimeter to tons per cubic inch, okay? If the sentence feels too prosaic, you need to look deeper. You need to challenge yourself more and discover the poetry in everything in the book, okay? Because truth is poetic, and the revelators are masters, okay? If it doesn't feel like a master wrote it, then you need to try a better set of initial assumptions before you start interpreting it.
Chris, I found this in writings I used to copy or write down what she would say in our meetings and stuff. And I found this one that kind of fits that. You said, it's how ignorant you aren't.
It's not how brilliant you are, it's how ignorant you aren't.
Right.
Yeah.
The conversion is brilliant.
Right. They just don't, it's so easy to do mind projection fallacy and underestimate the revelators. To see the book as a reflection of your consciousness. It's like, this is the way I would think about it. Therefore, that's the way they must have thought about it. They thought about how you would think about it, but they can also think a lot higher than that, too. Okay, don't forget that. They took you into consideration. They aren't talking over your head. There is an on-ramp for you. There's an almost infinitely deep phenomenon that is way over the head of a child of God, and you can go to full adulthood and still be immersed in it. You won't leave it behind. And it doesn't take much education to leave behind converting units on density, and that's not very fancy anymore. Okay. Right. Just think about what we'll know when we're on Uversa, and some of us might decide to be star students for a while. Right?
I'm just thinking of
ENSA. Getting to ENSA, right. All right, so I hope that helps you appreciate a little bit. See, they're trying to get, give you an object with some data that you could study more closely yourself, augment what they've said. They're trying to give you some things to hold on to about this internal physics that we have to completely rework because, it doesn't work anything like we think, as we try to rationalize it with the billiard ball model. That comes up pretty short, especially when you get very deep, and it's getting into states that are really beyond anything that's even remotely an extrapolation of what we've experienced. They're trying to give you some information there so that you could potentially refute your false theories, because you're a truth seeker, you know, and you can come up with a theory, but you've got to somehow be given the means so that you can refute the false ones and slowly over time find something that seems to be able to withstand your best efforts at refutation than the revelation's efforts at refutation. And it still stands. And it's like, maybe this theory is true. I've carefully looked at every sentence in the book, and I can't break it with any of the sentences. I mean, obviously, if I start modifying sentences, that's going to make that refutation and potential problematic. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is this old? Is it likely not in Nebadon?
Oh. No, it is very, very close to us.
I understand that, but how could it be that old?
Well, remember we talked about that last time. That was one of the things I was trying to get you to remember. Nebadon is not composed of just the very young stars of the Andromeda Nebula.
That's it. Older stars.
Right. Remember, Andromeda stars are a ninth of the total or a 20th of the total, right? And they're pointing out, here's an example of, this star, you know, was burning trillions and trillions and trillions of years before the Andromeda Nebula was even formed. Okay, and it was embedded down in the Milky Way galaxy long, you know, before the Andromeda Nebula was even brought into the Milky Way. But it got incorporated in. And so you can have a very young star like the Sun, and right next door, a very old star, because it's a heterogeneous mixture of a lot of stuff besides the million Andromeda stars.
Is that because gravity brings it towards?
Gravity's in play, but remember, the master physical controllers are the ones that are creating the collection. You know, they're building the collection of matter that's going to be a local universe out of the raw materials that are within the Milky Way and that are coming into the Milky Way, and they're saying, okay, we're going to guide this in, we're going to use this stuff that's already there, and we're not going to use that stuff, you know.
Potpourri.
And they make a collection, and they lock onto it, and they hold it together.
So when the Mother Spirit comes here,
right,
she then, the space that she occupies is Nebadon. And so she will occupy space where their stars are already
here.
Right, right. So all the stars are there, you know, they're basically. But there's no boundary line. It's not like before the Creative Mother Spirit's presence is there, or even the Creative Spirit presence is there, you know, that someone can go right there is the boundary line. They would have to be told, that star is in, that one's not. You know, they'd have to be told, you know. But she comes and, coincidentally, all the stars that are inside of her presence, right? I mean, she enwombs that collection of matter. Let's get into the solar radiation now. So you'll see that it didn't hurt to kind of get us thinking a little bit about the density issue a little bit, because they're going to pick up on that right away. We started doing the really kind of external things, and we've been going more and more internal. We're going to, you know, talk a little bit more about the internal doings here of the star. And this whole issue that we were, you know, that came up, how did it get from a solar mass to, you know, somewhere between 4 and 5 hundredths of a solar mass? Well, there's solar radiation, you know. There is energy and particles going outward, radiating, going outward, as a vector phenomenon from this sphere. Remember how at the end last time we were noticing they were talking about surfaces of stars, and the more you study it, the more it seems like they're saying there's something that really is kind of definitively spherical. It's not just arbitrary where you take a diffuse ball of gas and you say here's a dividing line, that there is some sort of a actual sphere, and that you're inside or outside. And so you can talk about what's going out of that domain of consistency, that spherical domain that's the inside of the star. It's exiting out the surface. Okay, that's what this is about.
Number 5, solar radiation. That the suns of space are not very dense is proved by the steady streams of escaping light energies. too great a density would retain light by opacity, I think, until the light energy pressure reached the explosion point. There is a tremendous light or gas pressure within a sun to cause it to shoot forth such a stream of energy as to penetrate space for millions upon millions of miles to energize light and heat the distant planets. 15 feet of surface of the density of Urantia would effectually prevent the escape of all X-rays and light energies from a sun until the rising internal pressure of accumulating energies resulting from atomic dismemberment overcame gravity with a tremendous outward explosion.
Okay. Again, see, we're not going to pursue all of the scientific lines that stem out of such a paragraph. Okay. But, you know, let me just, you know, help you appreciate what they're setting in motion there in terms of lines of thought. You see how they're picking up on, remember how we talked a lot in the previous one about how low density, you know, most stars are, that, you know, if it wasn't hot, you know, we could take you to that photosphere, that, you know, that visible surface of the sun, and you wouldn't even know there was anything there, right? It's a thousandth the density of the air in this room. I mean, you just instantly suffocate. Very, very low density. Yep.
There was a question from a couple minutes ago.
Okay.
Would that change not have been humanly made if super gases, but these and other unusual forms of matter had been considered?
No, again, I mean, if you look at the rationale for the change, you know, it's just that simple rationale that 1.5 is not 1, therefore we need to change it. And it's like, well, how could a typo go from 40 to 60, F-O-U-R-T-Y-S-I-X-T-Y, I mean, aren't those pretty different words? Well, the rational, you know, you can rationalize anything. You know, so you rationalize, well, it must have actually been a number. You know, 40000, and then it was just changing a 4, you know, between a 4 and a 6. You know, and then someone said, well, it's not proper form to put it in numbers. Let's write it out as a word. Yeah, sure, you can, yeah, again, remember, you can rationalize anything. Okay? I mean, you can, you got to remember, is it, you got to have some sort of a governor upon rationalization to figure out if it's a true or false rationalization. Just because it gets you a correct answer or an answer, I mean, doesn't prove anything. Okay, so back to solar radiation. So, now they're reminding you that it wouldn't take much. You don't want this star to be very thick in any way, or it's not going to be stable. It'll bottle up the energy too much, and then, it'll be like dropping a Mentos in a pop bottle, right? The thing is going to blow up.
Something you can do at home.
Right. Yeah. But don't do it without the proper goggles and this. Right. That will be shrapnel.
Shrapnel,
yeah. Right? Right. So, you know, you've got to, stars, you know, coincidentally, that the fact that they're very thin, see, helps with this issue. You can't avoid the fact that there's going to be a lot of pressure, and you have to be able to bleed that off in a stable way. You don't want to have to only resolve that issue catastrophically. Right? So that's very handy. Now notice what they start to get at here. They start out by saying light energy pressure. Okay, and then they say light or gas pressure. And we'll see as we continue on. Let me just help you to appreciate where this is going. The thing that they're going to try to help humans understand, and it's not just because they were writing for someone towards the beginning of the 20th century. If anything, it's actually gotten more problematic as we've gone forward over the last 100 years. Because science has gotten so fixated on mathematics, you know, and the answers that that mathematics gives. You know, they've so let go of having some sort of an objective philosophic picture that they're thinking in. We were just beginning to get the sense that light should be treated as a particle, at least in some instances. And that's pretty much fuzzed out. I mean, yes, we have this thing we call a photon, but in general, that's a designation for a packet of energy. And by energy, you mean something that's written in mathematical equations. You're not thinking, you know, in a literal objective way. And you'll see they address that later in this section. So an important thing for the revelators to do, not only back then, but still today, 100 years later, is to try to get us to definitively recognize and think in terms of that there are actual particles. And remember, as we get into paper 42, this will become more clear. By a particle in the revelation, you know that to be a collection of 100 ultimatons. Ultimatons collect into a fundamental foundational packet of 100 units together, okay, and make a particle, the thing that has the beginnings of being like a little billiard ball, you know, and why the billiard ball model works to some degree. You know, if ultimatons didn't collect into those, you know, groupings of a 100, you know, there would nothing would ever manifest a billiard ball model thing. In any effect, okay? But because it does that, that's why, okay? So it's one thing for there to be waves in the force charge. Remember, there's something that fills all of space, that pervades space, it's called the force charge of space, primordial force, 42, we'll talk about that some more. There's this medium, this continuous medium, and there can be waves in that, just like you have waves in, you know, in any sort of a quasi-continuous medium like water or air. And so, you know, when they're talking about the 15 feet, you know, of Earth-like density there, notice they say all X-rays and light energies. Okay, again, the light energies thing. So they're what they're pointing to is an actual particle. When they're talking about X-rays, they're using this in a very generic sense, where you can have those very short wavelength, high energy waves in the force charge of space. This ball that is this star is not only filled with particles, with various, you know, augmentations of that foundation of 100 ultimatons. But it also is filled with a sea of waves in the force charge. Another reason why it behaves so much like an integrous unit. Because any sort of space that you might imagine between two little collections of 100 ultimatons between two particles is filled by waves in the force charge. And the particles are coupled to the force charge, and the force charge, you know, is coupled to the particles. You know, it's one of the fundamental properties of ultimatons, is they're coupled to the force charge, dynamically coupled. So, you know, it's a system. And remember, it's all motion. So it's a sphere of motion, some of it which is a little bit more billiard ball-like, and some of it which isn't very billiard ball-like. Okay? And more like a sea of motion between the quasi-lumps. Okay? But actually, it's all one system. There is no actual disconnect. You know, the particles and the force charge with all of its waves and whatnot, you know, are all dynamically coupled. It's all in motion together. It's a very complex system. Okay? And what they're doing with the 15 feet is, at some point, when you're trying to figure out if you've got a valid internal theory for a star, you'd like to have someone give you some hint about how high the energies should be. Okay, so this is an indirect way to do it. How much would it take to shield these energies? Will a sheet of paper do it? Will a cinder block wall do it? How much? Will a foot of water do it? Could this energy penetrate that? We've studied this stuff. We know how penetrating certain energies are and how penetrating an X-ray is. We all know, as soon as we discovered how penetrating X-rays were, that was really cool to figure out what was going on inside the body, right? I mean, they definitely can penetrate. They're not stopped by your skin. They penetrate right through it. But an alpha particle will be stopped by your skin. It's not going to penetrate your skin. But an X-ray, will go through. Right? So that's what they're indirectly doing. Is there, they're saying, well, if you figure out something and it would take more than 15 feet, you're too energetic. If it'd take a lot less than 15 feet, you're not energetic enough. And you notice they didn't say effectively, they said effectually prevent. So that's also a clue. It's like, well, are they talking, 15 feet would cut it by 50%? No, it's basically going to cut it to zero. That's why they said effectually instead of effectively. Cutting it by 50% would be pretty effective. But effectually means very definitively effective, basically taking it to zero. So if a certain amount takes it 50%, how many more layers of that thickness is going to take, 50% of 50% of 50% of 50%, to get it down to basically zero. Right, so that's the kind of thing, that's a scientific sort of a statement, that a scientist is going to recognize. Like, oh, they're telling me about, how much shielding, would be required here. Yeah. And so they can get the mathematics out and they can play with that. It'll give them a clue.
If 100 ultimatons makes a particle,
mm-hmm.
and every ultimaton is the Isle of Paradise, so our bodies stay together only because of those ultimatons.
Yeah. Again, that at the center of the ultimaton is that influence of the Isle. Remember what that means. That's why an ultimaton can be this localized fact. It's a sphere of a definite radius, very, very tiny radius, okay? But it's a sphere of a physical manifestation of a fixed and constant radius because the influence of the Isle doesn't waver one bit. And so the ultimaton doesn't, heave and ho or anything. The Isle is constant, And the ultimaton doesn't diffuse away. It stays definitively. What keeps you localized? The Isle does.
Paradise.
Right? And it goes all the way down to the core. My molecules stay localized because my atoms stay localized, because the particles in the atoms stay localized, because the ultimatons in the particles stay localized, because the Isle says so. Mm-hmm. Right? That centering influence of the Isle. Right, okay, so all right, so that's what's, so in just a few, a few words there, and you've got to think about how they're using the language, what they're trying to suggest. Like I said, so the X-rays is talking about waves, and then the light energies is talking about particles. And then they threw in something that we'll get into a little later on that's also completely new, this idea that all of this dynamic stuff is going on because, it says, resulting from atomic dismemberment. Okay? That's not the current theory of energy generation in stars. Okay? Does fusion, they tell you that stars produce their energy by fusion. Does the word fusion sound like you're taking things apart or putting things together? right. We'll get to that later on here in this paper. Why it is that stars last much longer than we think, and right? Because the primary energy generation is something that current science knows nothing of. Yeah, there's fusion, but that's a secondary phenomenon. That's a high harmonic on a very deep fundamental. Okay. Yep.
Got a question here. So this is a law, and it's undisputable.
What is?
The right when I gave you the sign a minute ago.
I'm not sure what's what law we're talking about. I'm thinking probably that. Right. Again, remember, there's very definitive facts in science. That's the value of getting yourself into relationship with science. It will help. Remember, in order to have true religion, you have to have true science. And the simple reason why that's the case is a true religion is not predicated on figment. And working a little bit upon in a scientific mode where the universe doesn't care how you want it to work. It just works a certain way, and that's it. You have to accept it or reject reality. There's only two options. It doesn't work that way in the figments of religious worldviews. You can just imagine a universe that's whatever you want it to be and prove me wrong, you say. Right. You have an unrefutable worldview that you've based, your religion on. Can you develop a religion that is rigorous, that has to obey laws? It's like, matter's got to obey laws, but religion is about spiritual issues. Well, you need to read a couple of sentences in the book that remind you that spirit is a substance, and it obeys laws just as definitively as matter does. It works exactly the same way. You can't do anything with spirit. You can only do what the laws of spirit substance allow you to do. It's like, God could do anything. No, he can't. God can't violate the laws of spirit substance any more than he can violate the laws of material substance. And why would he, after all, if you believe that he's the first source and center of all things and beings, things like the laws? Remember, not God is law and God is love. This humbling yourself to facts, facing facts and adjusting them to ideals, not rejecting facts because they don't allow for the fancy religious worldview that you're hoping for. No, face the facts that obliterate your religious worldview and start over again. That's why it takes courage and not just independence of thinking. Difficult. Because no child of God has the facts correct. So your initial religion is not true. It can't be. for those of you who are in Total Deity, the final reflection we had there was, quoting that passage in paper 104. It reminds you of how the facts just don't care about how sincere your faith is. They don't care at all.
Sorry about
the
that.
Facts, they're just the facts. And you can be insincere, sincere, doesn't change the facts. They just stand there unmoved, waiting for you to face them and found a worldview on them. The one and only set of facts. They have no squishiness, they're precise to 90 decimal places.
Yep. I'm having a hard time with the simple term that spirit is substance, because it seems so much more than just a substance.
Your personality pattern on it is so much more. If you take material substance and mold it into a bomb, it seems like it's a lot more than just a substance. It's something with vast ramifications.
So when they say
spirit substance is the same way.
God is spirit. It just seems like so much more.
Right. But remember, he's a person, He's just an actuality.
Deity.
Okay? To say God is spirit, to say, okay, you can, you know, from an individuality viewpoint, think of him as a blob of spirit substance. Now purpose that blob of spirit substance with personality, with spirit pattern. Now, what do you experience? Remember, you can never experience the underlying actuality. You can only experience what it's been set in motion to do. You know, none of us are ever going to experience the literal substance of God's body any more than we can experience the substance of our body. You have no ability to experience the matter of your body. Your consciousness is not in the matter. Your consciousness is in the mind energy, which is absolutely separated from the material energy. All you can be conscious of is other mind energy. You can't be conscious of spirit substance or matter.
I'm conscious of my matter.
See, that's... We start out as children of God, it appears that we're conscious of our body. But you know, this is why we have Reawakening Philosophy 1. To work through what humans started to work through in the 6th century B.C., they started with that. It's like, well, I'm aware of my body. But then they developed reflective thinking. And they began to reflect upon this. And it finally began to dawn on them that they aren't experiencing your body. You can't experience your body. And does a revelation refute that? No. Several times they remind you right there in black and white, exactly what we figured out through reflective thinking. You cannot experience matter. You can experience something that has been put in your mind that's a representation of that matter. But you can't experience the matter. Okay? It's like, well, what if it's a poor representation? Yeah, what if that representation in your mind is a poor representation of the objective fact? What will you experience? Not the truth. Right? Remember that, you know? It's a very important thing to begin to understand that that you have a very squishy relationship to start, you know, initially to objective reality. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about matter out there or spirit out there. How do you know that the representation of God that's in your mind, that came in through, you know, your spiritual stimuli input mechanisms, just like experience of this table came in through my material stimuli mechanisms, how do you know that that representation is proper? How do you know that when that stimulus engaged your mind, that it didn't get reformed? And what you experience is not even remotely the fact. How do you know that you haven't twisted it? You don't initially.
You were so talking about like the first lesson in the Course in Miracles. This is exactly what they're saying. Okay. Nothing you see is real.
See, but it is. It is real. See, that's another thing. There's been a number of philosophers, you know, in thinking about what I was just saying, have concluded that that means there's no reality. No, that's false. And we figured that out centuries ago. So people who still think that, see, are way, you know, they're in primitive thinking. Yeah. Again, all this is very complex, and it requires, I mean, for me to just get you going on it, you know, we do 15 three-hour sessions, right? In Reawakening Philosophy, to just begin to see if we can get each of us from where we start, ignorant of all this, to the beginnings of a philosophic perspective on exactly what's going on. It's the most difficult thing that any human can do. The smartest people that ever lived, in general, have failed. You know, there's all kinds of really ridiculous, illogical philosophies that the smartest people that ever lived have produced. They're not, you know, they're called philosophies. They're doctrines. It's very difficult to properly reflectively think. That's why it says in the beginning of the book, if you haven't cultivated a lot of reflective thinking ability, expect more distortion, not less. Because it's, it only, you know, unless you can get better than someone like Hegel or Spinoza, you know, or even Descartes, you're going to muddle the revelation. You've got to think more clearly than that. The beautiful thing is the revelation helps you with this. It if you engage it with that effort, it will slowly over time help you to get into this mode where you aren't so deceivable.
That's why I love the beginning of paper 15, yeah. First line. As a father, the universe is virtually non-existing. You go, what?
Right. Anyway, okay, let's keep going here. We're going to run out of time. All right, so that's what they're, you know, so they're in that first one, you know, they're trying to, you know, get us to appreciate because it's thin, you know, this stuff can get out, you know, and we can see the sun in the daytime sky. We can get the light thing. You know, it said millions upon millions of miles. I mean, how far is it? How many miles is it from here to the sun? Does someone remember?
93.
Yeah, 93 million miles, right? It's got a lot of millions and millions of miles to even get to us, right? Yeah, is there something?
There's a question.
Okay.
Mind can change forms, how would you answer the question about how does one reflect on properly reflecting thing except scientifically by deduction? Is that a bit better?
Again, see, you've got to overcome that you can rationalize anything. Deduction is rationalizing. Okay? That's, you know, rational thinking is deductive thinking. You have to cultivate insight, inductive thinking. And then you have to be in a very rigorous mode of not trying to confirm your ideas, but trying to refute them. Okay? And the only way, I mean, that's why the revelation is so handy. It provides a quick refutation mechanism for every thought that humans have had. It's the authoritative elimination of error. You know, it's like, well, what about this idea? Oops, that sentence refutes it. Okay, let's throw that out, start over again. You know, and you quickly discover, I'm in a Descartes mode. I've just cleared the table of everything. I need to start all over again. Yeah, that's what you need to do. You need to start out not with a different collection of atoms than the 100 that we have, but you need to start out with a different interpretation of the collection of 100 atoms that we have. They're not what you thought they've been, you know, and neither is God. God is not what you have always experienced. He's something much more fantastic than a child of God can experience. He's something that eternal lighters can experience. Wouldn't you like to get started on that richer experience? All right, let's keep going here.
Light in the presence of the propulsive gases is highly explosive when confined at high temperatures by opaque retaining walls. Light is real. As you value energy and power on your world, sunlight would be economical at $1 million a pound.
Okay. Remember how in the previous one they said light or gas pressure? And here they're saying light in the presence of the propulsive gases. Okay. Remember what I said. You've got this phenomenon where you not only have particles like we currently tend to think of particles, but you also have basically those photon things definitively as particles, as collections of 100 ultimatons. It's all in a linked system. It's all a very dynamic state that is yearning to go outward. You know, if you heat something up, does it collapse? No, it tends to expand. Right, it's in a very outward mode, the whole system, and it's all coupled together. Okay, so just because, you know, that literally that particle that, you know, that is a photon particle, even though it doesn't have mass directly or charge, it definitely has definitiveness of particleness. It's a collection of 100 ultimatons and some additional energy. And it's coupled into this whole dynamic system. Okay, see, when they say light is real, okay, that, like I said, that speaks to today as well, you know, to that scientist today. Light is not just a packet of abstract energy. Okay, it's a particle. It's a collection of 100 ultimatons. Okay, and to drive that home, again, you know, when you read that last sentence there, doesn't it feel like we're maybe in relationship to some human source work, speaking like that, you know, as you value energy and power on your world, sunlight would be economical at $1 million a pound. I mean, talking like that, yeah, sure, they're playing off of human source work stuff, okay? And look at how, you know, they bring it home into the last word. $1 million a pound? I thought photons didn't have mass. They don't have mass. How could they have weight? You know, how could you think of them, you know, instead of so many kilograms, so many pounds? What are they getting at there? Well, again, just saying it that way is to remind you, think about them literally as particles, you know, that would have a at least a mass-like character, and they do. Those, even though they don't have, the photon particle doesn't literally have mass, it has momentum. It has oomph. Okay? And it has an effective mass. Okay? And you can do some quick little calculations, and the amount of energy associated with a pound of that effective mass, yeah, that would be, you know, if you spend $1 million for a pound, okay, it would be still way, you wouldn't have wasted any money. You could if you convert, you know, got as much energy as you could get out of it and sold it, okay, yeah, you know, you would be way profit in the way in the black here, okay. You wouldn't be regretting that you spent $1 million a pound on that. You know, and think of the, you know, $1 million a pound, think about the contrast, like, well, how would that relate to you know, the price of gold? You know, we'll do a little, you know, do a quick calculation. If you have gold at $1,000 a troy ounce, okay, this is like way more expensive than that, right? You know, see, so it's in that context that they're playing off of the source works. You know, you think it'd be really cool to be an alchemist and be able to make gold? No, there's something much more valuable than gold. Many orders of magnitude, if you convert it to, you know, how much you guys will pay for stuff at any age, then or now, right? The amount of energy there is huge, okay? And it's locked in that particleness. And if you disassemble that particleness, you know, that atomic dismemberment, that's not just ripping the electrons off. No, they mean taking the particles apart, okay? All right, so see, all of that is playing off of human things, suggesting where to go with science, giving you some anchor points, and very much trying to stress, like I said, what really needs to be stressed even today, there's no literal thinking about photons today. You know, they're just an abstraction. They're not a literal thing. Okay, they're a particle. All right.
The interior of your sun is a vast X-ray generator. The suns are supported from within by the incessant bombardment of these mighty emanations.
All right. See, like I said, so that you have this collection of particles, you know, and it's immersed in a sea, as it were, of waves in the force charge, very high energy ones. The contrast here by saying X-ray rather than saying gamma ray, you know, when you say gamma ray, you're actually thinking a little bit more about a particle, not just that it might actually be higher energy too, but that's the significance of them speaking of X-rays, so that you should be, if you're scientific, you know, if you have a scientific understanding of such things, you know, it very much reminds you of the wave part, you know, and we're going to get to that here in a couple paragraphs. And they try to help us with our confusion about waves and particles. Okay, so this ball of motion, you know, is, like I was saying, is very much, you know, you can appreciate it even on a superficial level as being integrated into a whole by this vast sea of waves in the force charge, X-rays, high energy waves. The atom is the same way. All those electrons work together as a whole because there's also this standing waves and the force charge that they're immersed in. It, you know, tends to sort of blur the particles out into a, into a region of space. See, and it's the same thing here. In many ways, it's like it all blurs it together. All the particles are kind of functioning like one great big particle that has a surface, that has a radius.
But the suns are supported from the moon. Is that?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I mean, the technical things. You have both. You know, scientists. You know, even now understand this. Okay. You have light and gas pressure. Okay. But you have this, and the light and the gas are coupled, like they're talking about there. I mean, technically, you know, the way a star, you can think about it being supported, is you have a pressure gradient that balances a weight. That pressure gradient is a force, and a weight is a force, and the two are in balance, and that's why it's basically a constant radius. It's not collapsing or expanding. You know, you have an outward and an inward, and they're in balance. Right? So that, you know, you've got this, like I say, you've got this coupled system of pressure with a gradient in it, you know, decreasing outward, obviously, right? And that balances that weight due to the gravity.
I've got a question here. Would mm-hmm. you be able to briefly explain how the Urantia definition of X-ray differs from our current science?
We'll get to that in paper 42. In general, right here, it doesn't differ at all. I mean, here especially, they're really trying to get you to not think of particles, but the waves and the force charge. Now, I mean, the thing that's really different is current science doesn't have a force charge. It doesn't think that electromagnetic radiation is waves in the force charge, you know, be it radio waves or X-rays. It thinks it's an electromagnetic oscillation that's going through a vacuum. It's sort of a self-supporting, oscillating phenomenon that goes through a vacuum. It's actually not. You know, there's a medium and there's waves in it. You know, and they move at the speed of light because the medium it moves at the speed of light. You know, the force charge is an outward motion at a speed we call the speed of light. So you have just, imagine putting a kink in it, and then the medium is moving, and that's why it seems like the wave is moving. All right.
It requires more than 500,000 years for an X-ray stimulated electron to work its way from the very center of an average sun up to the solar surface, whence it starts out on its space adventure. Maybe to warm an inhabited planet, to be captured by a meteor, to participate in the birth of an atom, to be attracted by a highly charged dark island of space, or to find its space flight terminated by a final plunge into the surface of a sun similar to the one of its origin.
I'm free, I'm free. Oh no, I'm back where I started. Fun little comic poetry there. Okay, just quickly, there's a very important little data point for your stellar interior theory there. I mean, scientists try to calculate how long it takes, a photon to rattle its way out from the center to the surface and escape. Now, they don't get anything near that long. Much shorter than that. Let's say 10,000 years, or maybe say 170,000 years on the top end. So this number is many times bigger even on the high end of estimates. See, so that's another reminder. It's like, oh boy, I got to have a totally different stellar interior than what I think I have right now in order to get, that drift time to be more than half a million years, to be more than 500,000 years. So that's a very important data point. And then, besides the kind of the poetry there, notice how, again, they're speaking about it's inside, and then it escapes, it goes through that surface, and now it's on a space adventure. See how they describe that? See, again, to help you to get really literal about this, to not think of it as just a ball of gas that just gets thinner and thinner, out to several light years away, but it has a surface and there's an inside and outside. And to get outside, to sort of be out of that really intensely coupled sphere of motion and to be more of an individual thing, be more your own little billiard ball, you know, in some environment. See, so that's what they're pointing out. See, at that point, the billiard ball model is going to work pretty well, you know, once it isn't so coupled into a complex system and it's more of a separate object, you know, in some sort of a environment. Okay, that's what they're referring to there, that transition. It's kind of like the difference between an electron that's way down close to the nucleus and one of those outer ones. The outer ones are acting more like little billiard balls going around. The inner ones, not so much. They're more like they're smeared out into a continuous system. Right? So the billiard ball model is not going to work way down in, but the billiard ball model will work reasonably well for the outer electrons, especially on a big atom. Same idea here, see. And then the one other fun thing there that's, again, very new physics, to participate in the birth of an atom. Okay, now there's nothing in current physics that imagines such a thing. Yeah, remember, technically, you know, it's completely the opposite. Right now, we think that all the atoms, except for the ones that magically were created in the Big Bang, you know, we think that they're all created down at the hottest, densest places down in the center of stars. Actually, they're created in the thinnest, you know, the most tenuous, coldest places out in the depths of space. It's just exactly the opposite of what we think. Like I said, in general, everything is the opposite of what we currently think. And so how much significant reformation of all of our theories are we going to have? We got to turn everything completely around. It's all very different than we currently think. Okay? And again, it's like, well, no, I experience all those facts. No, you experience your interpretation of those facts. And you've not properly interpreted them.
So one more time, why did the numbers work out? Why can the scientists predict things?
Well, can they really? I mean, you know, take a simple example. They think they've got a certain stellar interior theory, and you know, they know how it works, and then they see a supernova, and the star that blew up is one that can't, according to their theory. So how well is their theory working? Well, give them a week, and they modify their theory, and then it works perfectly. It gets the correct answer. Right? I mean, well, now take something that's more definitive, more rock solid. Okay, let's take atomic theory. Okay, we've got an atomic theory. Do you know that every time they've predicted something with it, it gets the incorrect answer? No, I've looked in the books. It always, you know, they show me the mathematics, and always, yeah, after the fact, they make a discovery, and then they ad hoc modify the mathematics until it gets that answer. But in general, it always predicts the incorrect answer. You know, they set up a theory that gets the correct answer for everything we've observed. And then we observe something we haven't observed, and guess what? It doesn't give that answer. But after some smart people play with it a little bit, it gets the correct answer. That's the mode we're in.
Got a question here. Clarify if you think space is potential, actual, or is it present with non-pattern and pattern? What pattern is it?
And space is a literal fact. We don't want to get into the details of space right now. It's a very transcendent fact. It's a co-absolute fact. But think about how profound that makes the motion that is a particle. That space is part of what that particle is, part of the motion of that particle. That means even if you're observing a finite phenomenon, it has deep, deep roots. Its roots go way beyond what you can experience as a finite phenomenon. It has absonite and co-absolute roots underneath it. It has to, or it couldn't have the influence of the absoluteness of the aisle as a nuclear fact. It's got to reach across that whole, you know, distance of nature to where it is. All right, let's read some more.
The X-rays of a sun's interior charge the highly heated and agitated electrons with sufficient energy to carry them out through space. Past the hosts of detaining influences of intervening matter and, in spite of divergent gravity attractions, onto distant spheres of the remote systems. The great energy of velocity required to escape the gravity clutch of a sun is sufficient to ensure that the sunbeam will travel on with unabated velocity until it encounters considerable masses of matter, whereupon it is quickly transformed into heat with the liberation of other energies.
You know, here, I mean, in general, a current scientist, you know, it would be tracking that. But they're trying to, again, reemphasize, think about them all the more literally, in the same way you literally think about something that has mass, you know, which a photon particle doesn't, and the way you think about something having mass having an escape velocity. You know, we were talking about this before. I mean, how much velocity do you have to give a rocket, you know, so that it actually escapes the gravity well of the Earth and doesn't just parabolically fall back to the surface? You know, see, they're speaking about that, you know, and, you know, to remind yourself to think as literally as you can about that massless particle as if it were a mass. And the current scientists say, well, we do that pretty definitively. We have a theory called general relativity that can understand the how a massless particle like a photon experiences a gravity center like a star in the same way that a planet does. You know, and we've observed how you know, say a light beam sneaking right close past a star gets bent, you know, it gets attracted and bent in its path. We have a theory that explains all that quite precisely. We get the exact answers that we measure, you know, for this bending of light by gravity, where these massless particles are acting as if they were masses. We have a theory. General relativity explains that, and it all is rationalized through a construct called space-time. This idea that there's this a substance-like fact called space-time that is curved and whatnot, and particles follow curved paths in that curved space-time. That's what should get all fired up in your mind as you read that paragraph, and then you read the next paragraph.
So, when I look up, you know, when you see a star, you look at the Hubble thing, you see a star that's millions and millions of light years away, or you look up the stars at night, and you see a little teeny little dot.
Yep.
Okay. Is that an actual particle reaching you?
Yes. Yeah, that little collection of 100 ultrons went scurrying across space all that distance to get to your eyeball. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You thought getting absorbed by another star was a problem.
And you noticed it got to you with unabated velocity, it said. As it was scurrying, it's not panting desperately when it gets to your eyeball. It just cruises right in. As if it went just 2 inches.
I want a different eyeball.
Eyeballs are no respecter, or photons are no respecter of eyeballs. Said it backwards. Photons are no respecter of eyeballs.
Where's Terry when you need her?
Okay, see, so that's, like I said, that's what they're wanting you to be thinking. It's like, okay, yeah, we know this stuff. We figured this out. Wait, is that what revelations do? Do they affirm your current theories? What do they say next?
Energy, whether as light or in other forms, in its flight through space moves straight forward. The actual particles of material existence traverse space like a fusillade.
You can say fusillade or fusillade. Both are correct. In other words, I mean, you remember like a whole bunch of projectiles, you know, like bullets being fired, you know, a whole, you know. I think of a machine gun spewing out a whole mess of them, you know.
Rounds,
right? Okay, that's a fusillade.
200,000 of those.
They go in a straight and unbroken line or procession, except as they are acted on by superior forces, and except as they ever obey the linear gravity pull inherent in material mass and the circular gravity presence of the Isle of Paradise.
Okay. The thing that's really revolutionary is hidden there, and we'll get to that in paper 42, and they say procession. That's serious new stuff. But right now, let's just think about it simplistically. So they're saying, you know that theory you have, general relativity, where you think you've rationalized all this with this reification of space and time in this construct called space-time. And by the way, notice that the revelators don't use that term. You know, it's time and space, not space and time. Mm-hmm. It's 180 degrees from the current theory. And you're reading this, like, well, yeah, no, general relativity says, yeah, you know, you've got this curved space-time around the sun. You know, see, like they're saying here is, except as they ever obey the linear gravity pull inherent in material mass. Okay, yeah, but, you know, start with the first part of the paragraph first, not the apparent affirmation in the latter part of the paragraph. All right, what do they say foundationally? Independent of any objects that you're thinking of this photon particle. You notice how they stressed the actual particles of material existence. Okay, so this collection of 100 ultimatons. That it fundamentally goes in straight lines. It doesn't follow some gigantic Big Bang space-time geometry that's has some gentle curve to it or something. There is no such thing. There is no such thing as space-time. That concept is a way of getting the answer, but it doesn't literally exist. Okay, you know, there is literally space as this co-absolute fact, but it has no curvature or anything in the metric sense of general relativity, and it's not imaginarily bound to time like it is in general relativity. They're saying there is, you know, the actual phenomenon is just the simple thing of like a bullet going in a straight line. There is no curved foundation upon which it rides. Okay, and even when you're talking about the gravity pull, say, of that photon near a star, like near our sun, the reason that you have that attraction, quote unquote, that towards each other relationship between the two phenomena, the photon particle and the sun, is because gravity is a motion, an inward motion, independent of whether there's mass. Okay, it's just an inward motion. You don't need mass to have an inward motion. Okay, so what that basically, that paragraph is doing is wiping general relativity off the board. Okay? Saying, no, you want to start all over again on that one. Remember, the whole idea is to go back before you started rationalizing in the 20th century and got off on these tangents. Find a true rationalization. You know, it'll get the correct answer just like your false rationalization, but it will be true. It will describe objective reality, not just a mathematical scheme to get the correct answer. You're, as a scientist, not just merely a technologist, you should be interested in what is objectively there, not just how to build global positioning satellites, you know, and those things that you glue to your dashboard. Right? You know, your car navigator. Those things work using the rationalization scheme of general relativity, but it's not a true theory. It's a false theory. You can come up with a theory that'll get you the same correct answers, but will actually describe objective reality, what a scientist is interested in. You know, So that paragraph is about general relativity. The next paragraph is about the other pillar of the 20th century. Let's see, make sure I'm not skipping anything significant there. I am. The circular gravity presence of the Isle of Paradise. Remember, we were talking a little bit about that circular thing, the fact that a particle is a sphere. You know, so that's the raw influence of the Isle into finite space. But there's what's passes into relationship to the finite via the dark gravity bodies around the central universe, and hence impose a length dependent phenomenon, you know, where you can have a super universe level and the first outer space level and and they're not, they have a certain size, and they have that elliptical and flattened and all that sort of stuff. You know, that phenomenon is not spherically symmetric and is not size, or scale independent. That's what they're talking about there. And remember, even an ultimaton, let alone a collection of 100 of them, if you send it on a straight line down the donut of the toroid of space of the super universe space level, if you send it down the donut, it will bend around. There's a tendency for it to bend around and follow the path. Right? So, remember that's going on, as a photon is coming radially in from the first outer space level, say, first it's going, as it's going, it wants to go straight in, but it drifts clockwise as it's, heading in. And then it crosses the boundary and gets into the super universe level, and it's wanting to go straight, but then it's drifting counterclockwise as it's going radially in, because there's those flows. Right? So that modifies it too. Yeah. And think about, the distortions that's going to produce and where you think a galaxy is. You look in the second outer space level, that thing is, taking this, modified path. It hasn't actually taken a straight line path to get to you, to get to that eyeball. All right.
Solar energy may seem to be propelled in waves, but that is due to the action of coexistent and diverse influences. A given form of organized energy does not proceed in waves, but in direct lines. The presence of a second or a third form of force energy may cause the stream under observation to appear to travel in wavy formation, just as in a blinding rainstorm accompanied by a heavy wind, the water sometimes appears to fall in sheets or to descend in waves. The raindrops are coming down in a direct line of unbroken procession, but the action of the wind is such as to give the visible appearance of sheets of water and waves of raindrops.
Okay, so a fun little relatable analogy to throw in the second half of that paragraph. But the first half is, that other rationalization that you have, very fundamental rationalization you have, to rationalize what appears to your observation. See, the italicized appear. Remember, that's what we're doing right now. We are very precisely observing what appears to us, and we are rationalizing it. We rationalize one appearance with general relativity. The other basic mode is quantum mechanics. Okay, this paragraph is about quantum mechanics. It doesn't exist. Okay. Those particles appear to be what you call wavicles. A wave and a particle at the same time, but they are not. They are a definitive particle, but they're not alone like you currently assume. They're not in a vacuum. They're coupled to the force charge of space, a continuum that pervades all space. Okay? And they're dynamically coupled. They push on the force charge pushes on them. For instance, just take a simple photon. Internally, it's an oscillating phenomenon. You don't need to know why or, you know, but just, it's an oscillating phenomenon. And it's coupled to the force charge. If you couple an oscillating phenomenon, you know, to that oscillating phenomenon, what's the force charge going to do? Oscillate. Okay? You know, you're going to be, you know, tweaking it. And that force charge isn't stationary. It's a motion. And so that bump moves out. And the bump after it moves out after it. And the bump after that moves out of that. You get a train of what, you know, distortions in the force charge that moves out. Okay? The presence of a second, and they say, or a third form of force, notice it's force energy. I'm reminding you. Okay, the main thing here, the second thing that they're talking about there, or let's see, is there another? No, I guess it's in the next set. Yeah, they're going to repeat that. Yeah, they're going to repeat that in the next paragraph. The primary thing that they're talking about here, in addition to the particle, is the force charge and the waves in it. That result from the two being coupled together. That it's not just energy in a vacuum, it's force energy. You know, that's a system too. The energy, the particles, you know, remember what's an energy? It's a differential. Differential relative to what? Relative to the force charge. The force charge is the undifferentiated, that's why it's force, not energy. Mm-hmm. If you differentiate from that reference, you have an energy. Okay, and you've got to differentiate from that reference a long, long, long ways until you get something that we call an energy, an electronic level energy. You know, but that simplest little differential from the force charge, an ultimaton, is an energy, but not in, you know, from a current perspective. Current science would say that has energy zero, because it's not until you build up a lot more separation from the foundation that you finally have something that is coarse enough that our coarse observation abilities is aware of, are, you know, that it appears to us, right? Right now we only know about what appears to us, and that's at the electronic level or above. Anything sub-electronic, like way down to the bottom, ultimatons, it doesn't appear to us right now. Okay, it makes no appearance as it has property equal, you know, all properties equal to zero from our current perspective. Okay, you have someone on the webinar?
Yes. I am persistent to bring Philo into this. Can we bring any theory to what wood is spirit? It is moving, but it is motion.
I'm not sure where that's going. Well,
probably step. Is there a theory that we might be familiar with, or someone had?
No. That's what I was about to say. I mean, the thing to keep in mind is you see where they seem to be setting general relativity aside, or you see where they seem to be setting quantum mechanics aside. Your first instinct is going to be to turn your second adjunct on high and try to connect the dots again. Because humans don't like it when they don't have a way to connect the dots. If you take their dot connecting mechanism away, like take their general relativity or quantum mechanics away, and they start hyperventilating. Okay, that's just the way you are instinctually. Okay, you're gonna wanna try, someone's gotta have the answer. Quick, I'm feeling, yeah. No, you gotta be courageous. Just let the old rationalization be set aside. I mean, obviously you can't set it aside if your job is to design, navigation systems and stuff, you know, or global positioning satellites and stuff. Okay, I mean, you got to play with that. It's the only thing you have to work with. But we're not in that mode right now. So just set it aside. I mean, you don't need that in order to maintain your internal integrity. You know, what they're saying is set that mode aside and try to just be present with what little beginnings you can find once you've taken all of that elaborate scheme away. It's like, well, I don't think I have anything. Yeah, you do. You have the Urantia book. The Urantia book is a better set of initial assumptions. If you reflect on it very carefully and courageously and patiently, it'll show you the way to begin to start to form dots again on this white, you know, sheet of paper that you have in front of you. And if you can begin to coalesce some dots, you can begin to connect dots again. But don't just randomly put some dots out there. Well, what about that guy's dots? Let's put those dots on there and try to connect those. You know, don't be desperate about it. That's what got us to the goofy atomic theory we have right now, is because they were desperate in just grabbing things and connecting dots. They should have just been courageously patient for a while. So do that. Just know that you know, if you have an interest in being a scientist, you can slowly start to rebuild this. It's going to be a very difficult process. And you're going to have to pick up on every clue in the Urantia book, no matter how subtle it is. And if you've misinterpreted it, you know, that's going to take you off on a false tangent, and you'll have to discover that down the road a ways and back up and start all over again. And right? But you can slowly get there. I mean, I've given you some hints. I mean, the quantum mechanics is a scheme to try to rationalize everything as billiard balls by making the billiard balls magical. And I mean, an example of them as being magic billiard balls is that they're a wave and a particle at the same time. I mean, you know, when you think of a billiard ball, do you think of a water wave? No, you think of a billiard ball, and a water wave is something totally different. Well, you just need to use your imagination and cram a wave and a particle together in this. Well, that's nonsensical. Yeah.
Wavical.
That. That's the point, right? See that, you know. You know, you need to turn off your relationship to the Holy Spirit and just cram it together and rationalize it. Well, I don't want to turn off my relationship to my logical acumen. That's illogical for something to be a wave and a particle at the same time. See, and that's what the relativists are saying here. You know, okay, there are no matter waves. Okay, that basic idea of quantum mechanics is what they're telling you here. There are no matter waves, quote unquote. There are particles. The wave is a separate phenomenon in a medium. Waves need mediums, you know. It's just like the mediumless electromagnetic wave we have right now for like radio, you know, waves and stuff like that. Waves without a medium, self-mediumizing waves, right? Okay. No, waves are in a medium. There's waves, there's a medium. Okay. It's like, yeah, but the mathematics works. I can get the correct answer without a medium. Yes, you can rationalize anything. But just because you rationalize doesn't prove that there are waves without mediums. You know, you need to know that by definition, waves have mediums. And to dream up waves without mediums is to go away from reality. There are no such things, okay? Just like you can't have infinite finite objects. You can't have black holes. It's like, well, the mathematics all works. It gets me the correct answers. Yes, but it's not logical, okay? It's not science. It's just mathematics. You want science. You want something that describes the objective reality. There isn't curved space-time. There aren't matter waves. Yeah, there isn't even space-time, let alone curved space-time.
If you wanted to become a scientist, for instance, I mean, not, of course, at my age, but if you wanted to become one, like in their age, you have young people, and then you have this, and everything that you're learning, or most of the things that you're learning is wrong, how would you progress?
Well, again, you know, I mean, what you do is, you know, if, for those in the webinar couldn't hear, she's wondering, it's like, if you wanted to become a scientist and everything you're learning in you know, in, at the university is quote unquote wrong, as she said. Like, well, step one is, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with righteousness, so it isn't technically right or wrong. It may be an incorrect theory, it may be a false theory, right? But there are facts still. Science still has facts that they're putting out, and you can get those. If you can just wait on rationalizing them. You know, so it's important to go through and learn what you can learn in the current educational environment.
Right. So you understand.
Okay. And don't go in there and try to change the way they think about things. Don't worry about it. Yeah, that's like trying to change someone's religion because you think if you don't, they're damned to hell. No, they're fine. You don't need to change their religion. It doesn't matter how primitive it is. They're fine. Okay? You don't need to change their science either, no matter how false it is. But you do need to get yourself grounded in the facts. And can you object, you know, use it as a way of really fostering, developing your objective discrimination. Can you be exposed to a set of facts in the current rationalization scheme? And can you separate the rationalization scheme from the facts? Or is it all blurred together in your mind? Okay? And there's a strong tendency for that. Remember, like I said, the rationalization scheme is this mathematical construct they have right now. It's so powerful in their minds that the actual objects have disappeared. There are no objects in quantum mechanics. The fundamental assumption is there nothing exists except abstract mathematics. Okay? Matter waves aren't actually real. Okay? In the current theory, they're just mathematical. And there are those that take that literally and say, we can get the correct answers with this mathematics, therefore we have proven that there is no reality.
Of course, you sometimes say there's motion. There may not be objects, so to speak.
But again, you know...
And from an evolutionary point of view, without what we have, and we're so young at this...
Right.
Again,
I'm not trying. You know, I'm not. I mean,
no, I understand that.
I'm not trying to be hard on them. I'm just trying to. You know, the challenge is. You know, is to just appreciate. Can you be independent of the current way of rationalizing? You know, like in religion, can you be independent of the way of the fact? You know, in terms of spirit facts, can you separate the spirit facts from the way they've always been rationalized? Humans have been having spiritual experiences for 1,000,000 years. Do you know that they've been misinterpreting those experiences? Are you saying they haven't had experiences? No, I'm not saying that. They've had experiences. Objectively, they've had experiences, but they haven't interpreted them properly. But I don't care about the experiences. I care about my interpretation. Well, that's where you need to start, right there. Are you in love with your interpretation of the experiences, or do you desire to just be with those experiences and to slowly learn how to properly interpret them? Which is first, the objective fact or the subjective interpretation in your mind? Which do you give more value to?
The objective.
You know, you should give to the objective fact, not your interpretation, no matter how sincere it might be. Okay.
Oh, wisdom does come from the
rain. Right, okay.
Before we get on the philosophy, I want to talk about the raindrops for a second.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, maybe I always have trouble with this. Because, you know, driving raindrops when they're in a sheet, they actually look like they're coming sideways. You can feel like
they're coming sideways. Right, right, right.
But saying they're going straight down, I mean, I know a lot of weather balloon, for instance, when you let it go up, you know, it'll end up way over there, but it's going straight up. So they can tell, you know, but it's really not sometimes. The wind is moving it. Is this the same kind of thing? Or?
Well, okay, I mean, you know, just take a simple example. I mean, the simplest way to understand straight line motion that doesn't appear to be a straight line, that seems, you know, like straight up or straight sideways, it seems to be diagonal. It's the sum of two straight lines. It's going exactly horizontal and exactly vertical. And you add the two together, and the sum is diagonal. Okay? I mean, when you actually analyze it, that's how you understand it. You don't understand motion as being along any line. You understand it as being a combination of lines precisely along three orthogonal axes.
So it's
Well, and that's not all it's saying there, but that I'm using that example. I'm using that as an example to help you to just begin to think about how you can have the appearance of all kinds of not just straight down or not just straight sideways. You know, it can come in waves, you know, of a sheet, but that's the combination of straight lines to give the appearance of curved lines. Okay? But fundamentally, see, I mean, how to think about it. I mean, fundamentally, there isn't some curved thing that particle is forced to move on. Okay. It's not bound to a curved surface. Okay. It's free to move. And because it's totally free to move, what it does is it moves, you know, in a three-dimensional system, independently in X, independently in Y, and independently in Z. And then it combines together to give some sort of a complex effect. But fundamentally, see, that's what they're trying to get at, is that you know that there literally isn't some sort of a thin gauze in the sky that raindrops are clinging to, you know, and that makes them look like they're in a wave. Or even like, say, an aurora, you know, and the aurora looks like a big theater curtain thing waving in the sky, okay? There isn't literally some sort of a substrate, you know, thin gauze that they're glued to, okay? That's what they're getting at, okay? all right, so, I mean, yeah, obviously...
We set the clock, right?
Yeah, obviously, you know, you could go on a lot on this, but okay, that's just the basic point. They're just getting the person who's interested in science to recognize that you've got to get beyond rationalizing the appearance. Okay, one of the first things that we discovered in the development of philosophy was the difference between reality and appearance. And it doesn't matter if most people have lost that again. We used to know this. Okay, you can go back to that. Current science has forgotten about the distinction between reality and appearance, and it's just rationalizing appearances, you know, and then recognizing that appearances aren't real, therefore there is no reality. No, that isn't how it works, okay? But that's our current belief system.
Okay. So, guy pitches a pitch, umpire calls it a strike, but it didn't go over the plate. So, reality is it didn't go over the plate, but the truth is it's a strike.
Okay.
It's all right. The curvature of the earth.
Last paragraph here. Let's.
Besides, you bought the hot dog.
Let's get the last one here. All right.
The action of certain secondary and other undiscovered energies present in the space regions of your local universe is such that solar light emanations appear to execute certain wavy phenomena, as well as to be chopped up into infinitesimal portions of definite length and weight. And practically considered, that is exactly what happens. You can hardly hope to arrive at a better understanding of the behavior of light until such a time as you acquire a clear concept of the interaction and interrelationship of the various space forces and solar energies operating in the space regions of Nebadon. Your present confusion is also due to your incomplete grasp of this problem, as it involves the interassociated activities of the personal and non-personal control of the master universe, the presences, the performances, and the coordination of the conjoined actor and the unqualified absolute.
Okay, so just quickly, the two things that we need to bring out here, just for our initial little cursory engagement of this. Notice how they're repeating secondary and other at the beginning. So like I was saying, the main quote-unquote thing that's secondary there, secondary to the particle, is the force charge of space. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the main thing. And then you know, there's also, when they say undiscovered energies, there's all of this sub-electronic level energy stuff that we can't measure right now, and therefore we have no belief in its existence. Okay, there's all of that stuff that's, you know, sub-electronic, capital E in our equations equal to zero, okay, but it's very much a, you know, a literal phenomenon. And, yeah, for instance, yeah. Not to, you know, and then they tell you there's all sorts of stuff in between ultimatons and collections of 100 ultimatons. Okay, there's all of this complexity, you know, and it's all a vast, elaborate system, and so it has systematic phenomena in it. It isn't just a bunch of billiard balls. Each of their own is their own little island universe, and randomly doing whatever the heck they want to do. There's all kinds of systematic things that are imposed upon it, you know, that will create systematic phenomena, like, you know, like you know, each person in the stand in a stadium is a like a point particle, but you can get them all to do the wave together, right? And going around the stadium, okay? That's why they throw in the thing at the end. I mean, not only are there systematic things that it can do just as material phenomena, okay, but imagine if you actually have a beings and presences, you know, that have a hold of this, you know? What if they want to make the wave go around the stadium? Then all the particles are going to do the wave around the stadium, okay? And you're going to be really puzzled about, you know, well, I guess the people in the seats in the stadium are both particles and waves. No, they're not. Okay? All right, so you know, that's the you know, main physics thing that they're trying to get in there, that, you know, this infinitesimal portions of definite length and weight, you know, you have these definite little individuations, okay, as well as all the wave phenomena that are coupled to them. And then when they, the way they throw that in at the end, why do they express it? I mean, when you're thinking of presences, performances, coordination, you know, you're thinking, I've got the presence of power beings, I've got coordinating of mothers, you know, as a ubiquitous phenomenon. And they're tying it all to, you know, independent of the details, to two endpoints: conjoint actor on one end, unqualified absolute on the other end. Okay? The idea there is, and make sure you don't forget about how the physical domain can be gotten at from two different directions, top down or bottom up. And if you think about power beings or creative mother spirits or any sort of, you know, presences, coordination, whatnot like that, coming down from the third source and center. Okay? And even if they're an impersonal phenomenon, like a mechanical controller, it's a downstepped expression from the third source and center as a person. You know, maybe not directly, you know, you may think of the, you know, those as being offspring of the infinite spirit rather than the conjoint actor, but, you know, turn the infinite spirit around, okay, and then it's the conjoint actor, right? I mean, there's a person, you know, behind it, you know, eventually, if you penetrate back far enough. Okay, so all of that stuff that's coming top down, you know, has a person, the purposing of a person behind it, okay? So no matter how impersonal and diffuse it might be down here, you know, the doings of Frandalanx, if you could see it in a big enough perspective, you could see the purposing of a person inherent in that phenomenon. And that's just top down, also bottom up. There's another person, God the Absolute. Okay, so another absolute influence. That doesn't come top down. That comes very subtly bottom up. It does. First step is, it's God the Absolute, but then you flip it around. The highest above, God the Absolute, you flip it all the way down to the bottom, and it's just the Absolute. And so it's not personalized deity, it's just deity. And it's a kind of deity where the way it impacts the universe, when the revelators are wanting you to focus on how that facet of deity, the absolute, impacts spiritual things, they will speak of it as the deity absolute. If it's like right here, where they're wanting you to think about how that facet of deity, the absolute, impacts physical things, then they'll speak of it, that influence, as the presence of the unqualified absolute. Okay, but literally, you know, in just the simple sense of one of the seven absolutes of infinity, the unqualified absolute, that's just a reservoir of the potential for material substance. I mean, it's nothing that has any sort of a influence at all. Okay, when they speak like that, you know, they're reminding you of what's behind that. Okay, in eternity, as opposed to in time, in eternity, it's, you know, the three absolutes are together as one, the absolute. And behind that is the personalization of that deity, is God the absolute. So you go far enough back, and there's a purposing of a person, you know, that manifests in this very unpersonal, bottom-up, subtle way, you know, that all of this is happening in the context of actualizing energy out of the reservoir of the potential for it. Yeah? It's one reservoir. Okay? So that's the deal there. Okay, so next time we'll get to the section that intrigued many readers for a long time. Why of the 100 elements is there a section on calcium? What happened to poor sodium? Or, you know, why calcium? So we'll see if we can penetrate the mystery of that section a little bit next time. But, you notice we even had to go way over again here just to treat this. But, and again, remember how much more we could have gone over. You know, we could talk for hours about the consequences of everything in here. It all has, even in terms of what I've already recognized, you know, is things that this implies and that implies. Okay, so not to mention people 500 years from now, what they'll see, right? Okay, so if you get nothing out of this, take that away. Appreciate the profound depth of the revelation and how you need to challenge yourself to be as humble in its presence as you've ever been. Be really cautious about thinking that you know what it says or what it should have said. Like it should have said 40. No, it says 60, and that's what it should say. And to be able to see it that way, to not see that as arbitrary, to be able to have that holistic relationship where you're minimizing how many false tangents you start on and are going to have to back way up and start over again. Try to not waste so much time on old wineskins in your relationship to the revelation. All right, let's take a moment here.